Hello and welcome once again to Let's Talk About Public Code, a show where we invite members of our community who are actively working with public code. My name is Jan Einarli, and I'm a codebase steward at the Foundation for Public Code. This episode was recorded on January 16 in The Hague. My guest in this episode is Astor Nemelin, Executive Director of Open Forum Europe. In this episode, we get deep into why and how software is getting to a point that it is becoming institutionalized and discuss about where we can go from here. Welcome to the podcast, Astor.
Thank you very much, Jan.
Before we deep dive into the hard questions, can you give our listeners a little overview about what Open Forum Europe does?
Sure. Well, maybe the interesting thing about Open Forum Europe is our age, or the organization's age. The team is relatively young, but the organization is, I think it's 21 years as of this year. And we've always worked in just the intersection of open technologies and public policy. So you can kind of think of us as, you know, prefix open, be it open standards, open source, open data, science, you name it. And we have been there over the years. So what do we do as a think tank? Well, the pretty standard stuff. Events, reports, but always with the goal of building more bridges between open technology experts and policymakers, just increasing the appreciation and understanding of what open technologies can do for society and countries.
And you've been around in this OpenX, as you said it, thing for 21 years. Have you seen a shift of like focus on what open, what the X is in the open?
Yes. Now, I've worked with these questions for maybe 6-7 years. Maybe I'm exaggerating. I would have to, you know, with the COVID years, I feel like it's hard to count. But listening to my predecessors and my board and people who've been engaged for over 21 years, we often come back to the point that there is often a cycle around, if we talk about open standards and open source, for example, we find that there's, yeah, it kind of oscillates between a focus on open standard from, let's say, civil society actors and advocates, between open standards and open source and policymakers. So people get excited about open source. That's kind of how OFE was started in early 2000s. And then you realize that, oh yeah, wait, we need to get the standards right. And then it's a big focus on standards. And then when that has been maybe not exhausted, but something new is needed, often come back to open source again. And then, of course, there's been a big kind of trend around open data, which, I mean, perhaps that's a discussion we might touch upon today as well, what that has meant historically for advocates of open and what it means now in the context of the large language model discussions could be quite interesting, because I think there's been quite a market shift. And it's very interesting to think about why open data became so talked about by policymakers, as opposed to open source and open standards in the last few years. While at the same time, I would argue open standards and open source has actually delivered more for society than open data has. But now I'm perhaps getting ahead of myself.
I think that's perfectly fine to ruminate about that. And when you think that, do you think is there interplay between these so that one enables the other, and maybe open data was too quick out of the gates, or is there something else going on in these cycles?
Now, answering very much with a gut feeling answer, I feel like theoretically there's a lot of interplay between, let's say, open data and open source. Touching on the theoretical part, the idea of collaboration and the sharing of information for increased innovation, I don't know what policymakers focus on, startups, job creation, etc. That's there. In practice, I feel like these sides have been these discussions have been quite separated. Whereas, I mean, maybe it is because there's been a lot more, perhaps even just lobbying, promoting open data. There's been some very large companies that have been very eager to get access to more data, whereas open source promotion might, again, theoretically, sometimes practically, have more of a zero-sum game for some very large funded organizations that are interested in keeping things more closed. Maybe.
That's very interesting to think about. Let's dive into why we met here today, because recently you wrote a blog post with the title, Some Thoughts on the Institutionalization of Software. what was the background for you? Like, what made you, I need to write this now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Are a lot of more blog posts needed? Like a lot of writing, and I think I'm not alone in this, it's a way of gathering thoughts and different diverse observations in trying to bring it together into a coherent whole. And writing in any form is quite good for that. But what in the last 2-3 years we have observed at Open Forum Europe is some very clear indications that we're moving towards, well, this institutionalization. And I think for people who are not political scientists or have a political science background, institutionalization is a funny word because it sounds like, well, you're being put in maybe an asylum or something like this. So that's not what is being suggested in this text. It's rather technology markets have over the last 200 years, be it from, you know, seagoing ships to the telegraph to satellite TV to the internet, gone through this pretty standard cycle where it is a quote-unquote wild west of innovation and excitement. And then it reaches a point of importance, size, weight in society that rules and regulations are seen by governments that this is needed, needs to be put in place. But not only governments here, it's also you reach a point where the, let's say, winners in these markets, if you will start to understand that we have now managed to establish ourselves, and this free-for-all Wild West could potentially create a lot of competition for us. And then it's quite, you know, the model argues that together with the governments, they will invite government to regulate it and regulate markets so that, well, their positions as incumbents are established longer term, which for those who work with open technologies, not in open technologies in and of themselves, but are concerned with, you know, user choice in competitive digital markets, etc., might see this as, you know, a bit of a worrying trend. But when I say worrying trend, it's inevitable. I don't think that the response to this is just to refuse regulation in any way. It's coming. I'm not the only one saying this. And that comes to the other side of, well, when the rules for software are being written, what will be the role for open source, OpenX? Will the open ecosystem, especially here I'm thinking of the very diverse and large open source ecosystem, be able to organize themselves in a way so they can be at the table when these rules are written? Because so far, and I guess that, to come back to your original question, why I wrote this blog post, with the Cyber Resilience Act, with the Product Liability Directive, with the AI Act, we've had the feeling that there's still a lot to do in terms of organizing the open source ecosystem. You know, as Open Forum Europe, we don't speak for open source in any way, but what we can sometimes help with, which we've done in the last 2 years, is spend some time and effort in coordination.
And you mentioned here the rules for software are being written. And there's a trend also that we have noticed where law is being trying to be implemented as code, or sometimes already written code is almost treated like it is the regulation as such. Are these orthogonal to each other, these two trends, or do they just happen to correlate in time? Do you see any relationships within these?
I mean, it's a very good question. Now, I haven't thought about the connection between those two things, but I would agree with you with the trend you're pointing at. I mean, there is, not just in Europe, but also in the US with the Malamud case, a lot of interesting questions of, like, I mean, if you look at software regulation in practice, what you will see is, like, yes, you have the law and the regulation. This will then be translated into standards, which then by extension will be implemented as different business processes and as code. So there are many different points where, like, traditionally in Europe, one would argue that a standard is not a law. This is being challenged because there are elements of, well, again, a standard is one thing, but if we, like, for example, in Europe, start writing, I think the term is common specifications, where simply the commission writes the standard. You've seen similar trends in the US, that where NIST is looking to do similar things. Suddenly, we're getting a lot closer to the policymakers writing the laws as code. I am not 100% sure how good this is, to be honest. I would say I'm instinctively skeptical to this as a good way forward. There is, however, a question around the inevitability of this, that, you know, and you can write a lot of things in any law or regulation, but the effect will be in the enforcement, as anyone knows who's worked in this space and followed laws that they've been very excited about over a few years when they've been in power. The connection with the institutionalization, well, maybe I would see it as standards will play a way bigger role, like traditional standards, European standards for software developers, companies selling software products and services, public institutions that develop or buy their own code. They will have to deal with standards affecting how, or standards through which they can fulfill the demands of the regulation. And it's going to be very important for the open source ecosystem, again, the very diverse open source ecosystem, to understand how they can interface and engage in the standards writing process, because the devil will be in the detail.
It usually is. Yes. And for our listener who might not be aware of the Malamud case, that is the case in the US where standards are being referred to in the law. And now there's a ruling that it should be fair use to also retrieve and read those standards. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. And this is sensitive, of course, because standards organizations have different kinds of business models, but some of them have the way they fund their work. And they need to fund their work somehow. That I think everyone agrees with, is by essentially selling the access to the standard. So I think for, and Jan, you will know this really well, of course. I mean, it's kind of a traditional copyright discussion. Creators need to be remunerated, but what about the societal need to have access to it, etc. It's very traditional conversation, I would say, in some ways. Right now, I think anyone in this space who doesn't have like a very strong position on the copyright question itself is just waiting for more clarity. Like, where are we at actually?
Yes, it's certainly unclear in many areas when it comes to copyright. I think we might come back to that time and time again. But you also mentioned, like, you went over the seas here and talked about the US, and we've seen specifically in the recent Cyber Resilience Act, a lot of American companies being interested in what's happening. Do you see similar interest from Europe to the other side? Does Open from Europe, even though you have Europe in the name, do you watch what's happening and follow it closely, trying to lobby?
Not really. I would say following it closely, but we don't really engage. I think it's one should be careful with stepping into other jurisdictions. You know, we even try to be very careful trying to understand the national politics of a European country that we engage with. It's easy to come in from, in our case, Brussels, and just think that we know what's going on because we have read some cool book. But there's definitely been a lot of interest from US companies, but also Chinese companies. I would say any large software vendor has been very, very interested in the CRA and the PLD. And where are the large software vendors? Well, a lot of them are in the US and in China to some extent. We have some in Europe as well, who have been very engaged in this as well. I think the thing that really stood out for me in the CRA discussion, if we look at the European interest, I know I'm jumping away from your question a little bit here, but there was a delayed response in European traditional industry to the CRA. I would say, this is me generalizing broadly, but let's say automotive industry, banks, etc. First, they saw the CRA as a great tool to de-risk their software supply chains. Well, oh, this is outstanding. We put the responsibility on the people delivering the software to us, and then if something goes wrong, we are off the hook. I would say after a year of discussions and negotiations, there were, realizations that, wait, the indirect effects that the CRA, as it was drafted originally, that they might have on open source, in Europe, just open source activity, because for those who don't know, there were a lot of concerns around the CRA essentially cooling the willingness in Europe to share code, because if you put code out in the public, it could have been considered placing it on the market, which is the technical term. And then that would come with a number of responsibilities. Even if you're an individual developer just having fun in that after work creating something, or if you're a large industrial company in Europe that wants to share its code into the community upstream. This, if you believe in the economic, social, and political potential of more open source code in society, is not a good thing. And what was very interesting is that large industrial companies in Europe do believe in the social, economic, and political potential of open source for their future survival, to be honest. They cannot do business today without a fully functioning and rich and active open source ecosystem in Europe or globally. So it took a year, but they really woke up to the question as well. Let's say the big users of open source.
And besides the big companies in Europe, you also describe a couple of open source alliances, some new ones, ongoing events and trade associations. What role do you think, or do you hope, that they will have in a policy landscape going forward from here?
Well, I think to step back, because it's easy with the CRA and PLD to sit around and complain about regulation that isn't shaped in a way that is tailor-made for open source. Well, one also has to ask himself, why isn't it? And I think we could probably have a 3-hour conversation about that. But I think everyone would agree that for open source to be appreciated, open source stakeholders and experts need to engage. And to engage in the political discussion, that requires resources. It costs money, it costs time. And here, a larger software company will, it will be easier for them to just kind of coordinate both within the company itself, understanding its position and view on regulation, but also within well-organized trade associations. And I think if I look at software regulation and the reaction to it in Europe, it was really underscored the importance of an open source business association in Europe. Now, luckily, one was started just a few years ago. Full disclosure, I'm on the board of this organization. And for anyone who's worked in Brussels and just, you know, walked around the EU quarter, you will see trade associations for the most niche industries that you would never think would have organized themselves. I don't know, manufacturers of a very particular type of paint will have an association and a person in Brussels to just safeguard and raise their interests. Now, it's not only that they're there to lobby because they want to lobby. It's also that the EU system, the way it's built, is around multi-stakeholderism. You need to be a registered stakeholder representing something to be able to have a voice in the conversation. Yes, as a citizen, you can. There are a bunch of channels through which you can raise concerns as well. But to be in particular in, let's say, industry, for an open source industry to, or for any industry to respond to a request for input on a law or a policy effort, you need to be a registered stakeholder. And it really blew my mind a few years ago when the European open source business industry, whatever you want to call it, did not have a stakeholder representative in Brussels. Now, a lot of things are happening both in the wake of this CRA and the PLD, but the fact that there was an association that, because again, open source is not a monolith, a large software company that sells a proprietary software product will have a lot of strong open source interests, because open source is just software today. So will open source foundations. So will individual developers, so will small let's say, European companies. And I'm saying European here because if you look at our software industry, it's medium-sized and small companies as a rule, very large long tail. But also within that group, there are very diverse interests. Are you a consulting company? Are you a software vendor? Are you a systems integrator? There are a lot of different interests there as well. But the tradition of having a lot of those disagreements and fights out in the open, which you have around code development in open source, doesn't always work so well in the context of politics, because a policymaker wants a clearer response. Is this good, bad? And so the coordination, again, within the broader ecosystem will be crucial now when more rules are being written. So the CRA, the PLD is in some ways just the start. I think we'll see similar things in other jurisdictions, in the US, Latin America, China, India, you name any big country, and you will probably see something along these lines. And that will also be a challenge for open source, as it is global, but politics is inherently regional or national.
And it's very interesting because you're dead on when you say open source is not a monolith. And politicians, they want something clear. Are we disserviced by just having one term for everything from like the huge open source industry things to the hobbyists who never make a dime? Would it be beneficial for the movement to try to get more labels for different things?
It would probably have some benefits, but I think the risks of doing that would overshadow the benefits. And here it kind of goes back to the open source definition, which is under pressure and challenge by very moneyed interests that have very large patent portfolios that are not necessarily super excited about the trend towards open collaboration and more royalty-free standards and de facto standards being created by, or open source projects becoming de facto standards. I think, yes, in politics and policy, having more labels and terms would help my day-to-day, but the open source definition is not there to make my life easy. It's there to describe something which is quite amazing, that that individual developer and hobbyist is collaborating and has access to the same code as the largest companies. And that is where, you know, open source gets very interesting. It manages to do... There's one thing that I can't almost think of any other societal institution has managed to solve, which is collaboration between really diverse organizations. Yes, asterisk, there are massive diversity issues in terms of contribution to open source, but looking at diversity in terms of just the kinds of organizations that participate, you cannot say that it's not diverse. Yes, there are a lot of white guys who are, and there are a lot of guys that are contributing, but they are doing so from very different kinds of organizations. And I think there are enough forces that are pushing towards fragmentation in this space that I would not argue for this. But I see the benefits that you're describing, but I think the risks are too big.
Yeah, and while this was an idea I had now, I completely agree with you. Like, we shouldn't try to redefine the open source definition, but there are like another axis, so to speak, like from industry to hobbyist, where we see the same, like in soccer, you have professional soccer players and you have the people just playing once a week on the weekend. And the same rules and the same definition of soccer applies, but they are treated very differently. But
that's a nice analogy, actually. I would have to think about it more, but it is a very interesting analogy to think of. Absolutely. The rules are the same, but also, now to really push this football or soccer analogy, is what we want a super league in open source, or is the exciting thing about football, at least in theory, that you can, at least just in theory, go from your amateur team, and if you're just work hard enough, you could make it to the top flights and one day win the Champions League. Maybe now we're going too far off in the world of metaphors, but really, I think one should appreciate and celebrate the strength of these very different kinds of worlds coming together I mean, think of how hard it has been over the last 50 plus years, 60, 70 years now, maybe, of European integration and collaboration in Europe. We're trying to get really diverse countries working together, kind of standardize laws. And in theory, at least, if we're coming back to the question of laws as code, maybe this is a very interesting vehicle to just help this collaboration, make it smoother without a lot of forcing mechanisms. There is something very fascinating, just to kind of bring it back to something a bit more concrete, to think about, Jan, what your organization does and just the power of the open source license as a creation for collaboration between public institutions and civil society organizations, companies, big or small. The fact that you can just start collaborating. There is a legal institution in place that is trusted and established, the open source license. You don't need to write contract. You don't need to write MOUs. Yes, you will need some coordination, arguably some stewards, but the collaboration, they're very, very low, if any. You know, the barrier is interest and skill. And yeah, I'm just instinctively against any kind of fragmentation and labels in this space, even if, as you say, perhaps it would make my life easier.
Yeah, I think I probably agree with you there. You also say in your blog post, and I think we're almost touching on it now, like software is omnipresent and underpinned by an open source ecosystem that few policymakers fully grasp. I think you're almost generous there. I think there are few people in the world who fully grasp it. But besides that, how can policymakers be helped through this, even though they don't have a complete grasp of the thing?
This is like the question in some ways that OFE has been dealing with over the last 21 years. And to be a bit self-critical, we've been here, we've been in Brussels for 21 years. And despite that, we got a CRA that was not, I think that's very important for us to acknowledge and be a bit soul-searchy around, like, why, at the same time as we see very exciting, positive policy efforts across Europe around open source, especially in the public sector, but you see it in traditional industry as well. Really big efforts to have, let's say, the automotive industry collaborate together on software solutions for competitiveness, digital sovereignty, you name it. While we're seeing all these things, the CRA was framed the way it was framed. And in some ways, we have tried to understand this, and the way we've tried to understand how this came to be, why they didn't fully grasp the innovation model, I think there are a lot of sources for this. One is the lack of professionalization and, might sound a bit patronizing, but maturity in the open source ecosystem when it comes to policy work and engaging with governments as trusted partners. At the same time, the CRA is an extension to get a bit EU legal technical here. What the CRA is an extension of what is something called the New Legislative Framework, or the NLF, which is what has ruled product liability regulation for 30 years in Europe. You don't just change that overnight. Now, there are discussions around updating the NLF, but there's history, inertia, you know, a body of law that we have to relate our recommendations and understanding software regulation within. But then there are also the small things. Why wasn't the Open Source Program Office and the European Commission engaged in the drafting of the Commission? No complaint should fall here on the Commission's OSPO. They're doing great work, and the Commission is big, and there are many, many laws that were written in the last 5 years. So it's not on them, but, you know, having a very basic checklist internally, where if you write a software regulation, check with the Commission OSPO. You have experts internally. That could be, maybe the OSPO is too new still for it to have the kind of in-house appreciation for what they can bring. But how can policymakers help grasp open source? I think maybe the key here is what you said, that a lot of people don't grasp it fully. I don't know if I grasp it fully. The immense size and impact of the open source ecosystem, I think it's difficult even to think about because of how large it is and how omnipresent it is. But I wonder if there's a way where you can have appreciation for something without full understanding. The analogy that we often talk about at OFE is the appreciation policymakers have for SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. They might have never run or started a small company. They might not even know anyone who's done this, or they might not fully understand what it actually means to run a small and medium-sized company, but they know it's important. Another way of looking at it as something that people don't necessarily understand as a policymaker is infrastructure. That framing of open source, which is a very fair one. It's hard to argue that open source is not, or software, especially open source software, is not part of our critical infrastructure today. And policymakers understand that we need bridges and roads without knowing how to build bridges and roads. I think you can have an appreciation for something without having like deep understanding. At least I hope so. I'm not a developer myself, and I talk about open source all the time.
That is a very interesting analogy in the sense because they have so fully understood it's important that I think almost every government have something like an infrastructure ministry or department of infrastructure or something like that. And following that, agencies and hundreds or thousands of civil servants giving advice all the way up. Is that where we need to land, maybe not just for open source, but for software in general?
It's a very interesting question. And here I'd like to be a bit careful because that's at the same time as open source is large. It can be used for a lot of different things. I am certain that there are people at military think tanks across the world analyzing how the open source ecosystem can be in different ways, either weaponized or sanctioned to give one country or one, let's say, player in the geopolitical space benefits over others with open source. So, you know, inviting governments in might come with some baggage as well. Maybe it's inevitable. That's a discussion. But I think here it requires a lot of thinking, and it will require, like, who is the go-to expert in Europe on the relationship between European trade agreements and open source? We don't have one, I would say. I can think of one or two that I would ask, but there isn't an established group of people that think about this. You will have that for standards. You will have that for almost any other industry in Europe. Do we have people that think about the role open source has in terms of shaping future technologies? And here it's a kind of a governance question, the institutions that are in place in open source and how these projects and how they're run and how that shapes technology. Here I would recommend taking a look at the last Chinese five-year plan. I would argue that China is the largest economy with an explicit and established open source strategy, which includes promoting Chinese-founded open source projects. Because it is, I heard somebody describe open source as the diplomacy of the tech world. Both with, we definitely know it from the soft power point of view. It is definitely worth thinking about what the hard power element of that diplomacy is as well, because people are thinking about it in governments. I know this for a fact.
I'm going to leave that hanging for our listeners, and maybe we'll come back to that later. But I want to step back to a question here a little bit. And rather than say, how can policymakers be helped? How can policymakers help themselves be more educated if they are interested in this topic to make better policy or to come up with better amendments to existing proposals?
Well, here it's, Jan, both you and I have worked for politicians in the past, and we have been tasked with gathering input and testing ideas with different organizations. You don't sit in isolation and just come up with amendments or laws. But it is hard and it is challenging. Good lawmaking arguably comes from the different systems that are in place already. I think that as critical as I've been now on this podcast or in this conversation of the CRA and PLD, there's a lot of good regulation coming out of the EU. And the reason for that is, well, we have systems for you know, it's like it's called everything from like better lawmaking and the different ways of gathering input again from stakeholders. I think on the one hand, we need to ask from specifically an open source point of view, responsibility must fall on small and large companies, foundations, individual developer, interest organizations, civil society to step up and participate in these organizations, both when it comes to investing in policy work, but also research work that, you know, you need, any company selling proprietary software will have spent a lot of money on market research explaining why this software is the best thing since sliced bread. Possibly we need some more of that for open source as well. But that's specifically to open source. There, I think it is about stepping up. Again, perhaps sticking with open source, I think governments across Europe, not everyone, not at the same level of maturity, but have appreciated the need for an interface with a broader open source ecosystem. I think this is a way of understanding the building of the open source program offices. I think OFE, in some ways, Foundation for Public Code, were interesting kind of middle layer organizations trying to be translators. OSPOs are a way for governments to take in information and give out information to the open source ecosystem. It is a, I heard somebody using the analogy of a train station interface, API, you can call it whatever you want to make it sound a bit techy. But, you know, there are ways of talking to the government and they're building new ones because they need to gather this information. CISA in the US, what is it, Critical Infrastructure and Security Agency. I hope I got that right. They're building an open source program office now to just understand better what the government's role in securing open source is. It is, I hate to say it, a more humble approach than writing just the CRA as we did in Europe. But it is, you know, let's first write a law that says the government should build an entity that is essentially an information gathering OSPO to understand open source better, to be able to write better laws. So that's very interesting. But what can we do to just write better legislation in general? Well, I think there are probably thousands of books that have been written on this topic, but open source is probably the biggest concept or idea in the digital world that is not broadly understood. We're talking about all these verticals, be it AI, IoT, cybersecurity. Open source is everywhere. It is the horizontal aspect of all these things, simply because, again, software is eating the world and open source has already eaten software. So it's everywhere.
You're already dreaming a little bit about how to create policy, but if you would be more specific, like how, like what are some concrete, or not concrete, but doesn't need to be that. What areas would you like to see European policy for open source to go in a large time span, not just like with the sitting acts, but like if you think about maybe 10 years, what would you like to see coming out from the commission?
Yeah, maybe let me start with some of the classic boring but so important things. Something I would really like to see is an inclusion of open source matrices in the DESI index or the European semester. Like, we need to start measuring open source activity, skills, contributions, amount of code, security of code. There are a lot of different things in terms of just, you know, what you don't measure doesn't exist. And I think these matrices, I would say, first of all, we need to start investing in the creation of what are relevant ways of measuring open source. What is the interesting thing that we need to, what's interesting for governments to understand? So that's step one. And then two is including these in the big, I think the OECD should look into having these measurements as well, BESI, etc. I think that's one of those kind of technocratic things that could very easily be overlooked. But then the classic thing, capacity building in governments. Now, to make that a bit more concrete, open source program offices, absolutely. But if you look at, again, not telling a bunch of national governments what they should do because they have their own institutional setups and constitutional setups. But if you look at the European Commission and the number of civil servants and units and bodies they have for standardization, maybe that's a place to start to look at what we would need for open source. There's a relatively newly founded high-level forum for European standardization. Should we have that for open source? Should we have a... The title in the commission, the new one, is something like head of standardization or like chief standardization officer or something like this. Should there be such a role, or is such a role justified for open source as well? Now, maybe it's not a specific one, but aren't we in a place now? Like, I mean, if you look at any CTO or CAO in a private company today that deals with software in any way, if they don't have an open source skilled team or an open source program office, I mean, it's like professional misconduct. That should probably be the case for governments as well. And yeah.
So I think if I can see if I understand you correctly, your theory here is more than like one specific law that we need. If we enable the body that creates the law to be internally very good at handling this, it will seep into everything that needs it, rather than so that everything is sort of like everything that passes by will not only pass by the standards office, will also pass by the OSPO or the directorate. So that it gets into everything rather than one big thing.
Yes, I mean, in that getting into everything, quote unquote, here. Maybe that's necessary because open source is already in everything. That might be good to have in mind. But also, before I start asking for a law, I think making sure that the people that are writing the law have good ways of communicating with the open source ecosystem, that would comfort me. At the same time, because of the peculiar nature of open source, it's not just about governments hiring all these open source experts. Listen, there's a massive lack of open source expertise in the world. If you're really good at working with, if you're a software developer really good at engaging in upstream in open source communities, you might not be super attracted by a government salary. That might not be the solution, even though I would urge a lot of open source people to, you know, do some public service. But maybe before we start, the OSPO construct is super interesting because it's on the one hand about training and increasing expertise, knowledge, and capacity and capability of the organization it's in, but it's also an external entity that is meant to be the, you know, absorb information, skill, and code practically from the outside. So it's not just about the in-house skills, it's about how that in-house skill then also relates to the broader ecosystem. At the same time, now, of course, I should probably have this in a nice argumentative bullet point form, but at the same time, as governments, like any other organization, become more active, maybe contributing code, developing its own code, and being active in open source ecosystems, let's keep in mind that there is an open source ecosystem already in place, and many governments will be the new guys and girls in that space, and there are established norms and things that possibly need questioning. But I think just rolling in and being, hey, we are the government, listen to us, I suspect that won't work. There's been some examples of this from companies trying to do this, and it usually doesn't work. But I think, step one is this capacity building. Then how this expresses itself, well, if we have something like this in place, together with the correct measurements of the, you know, gathering data, we all want data-informed lawmaking. That's a very good starting place, I think, to start thinking about the big questions. I mean, the Chinese government has an open source strategy. Europe has an EU standardization strategy. But we only have a commission, very ambitious, but still only a commission open source strategy, which is an internal document. That is not the same thing as an EU strategy for open source. And in order to get there, we need to start asking some really interesting questions, such as, what is a nation's open source goals? That is a very different conversation than, let's say, what most open source advocates have had in history, which have been, how do we make it so that the government procures more open source? This is a different kind of conversation. How do we have an open source enabled and skilled workforce in our country? How are our interests voiced in large open source projects if they have political implications, which I think now open source needs to start admitting that as a you can say that you're apolitical for the longest time, but politics will come and get you at one point or another when you get big. So I'm going a bit all over the place, but getting measurement, research, understanding of open source together with capacity building in the form of OSPOs for the commission, a high level forum on open source would be a very good place to start in the next few years. Then we can start having serious conversations about everything from open source strategies to government's role in securing open source software, be it in funding or through legislation. That's when we can start talking about, like, how can the innovation policy that we have put in place, very focused on patent, perhaps be enriched by having an innovation policy across Europe? A lot of investments come into the space that also have an understanding and appreciation for open source as a way of creating innovation, not just patents.
You have so many good things here, and so I have so follow-up questions to go for days, but I think we're closing into an hour here, so I think we should round this off and leave this, all your questions you just had, as an exercise to the listener, and hopefully we can get some meaningful replies and responses on this podcast. But we always end with one question, and that is, which person would you recommend that we invite for a future episode?
I think, let me see here, we're in the Netherlands. That makes me think of Dirk Willem. Sorry, I might butcher your last name because it's Dutch. Van Geulik, one of the Apache founders and works with public policy now. And he has a long history and worked in both government and open source. And I think he can probably even further explain the things that I've tried to explain and correct me where I was wrong. Maybe going a bit international and talking to Ava Black at CISA, who's the, I think the title is like open source lead at the Critical Infrastructure and Security Agency in the US. They would be very interesting to interview here as well. And just to flatter your organization a little bit, bring in Ben Severny. He's always interesting to talk to and has a lot of good ideas. I like talking to him.
So great recommendations all around. Thank you so much, Aster, Executive Director for Open Forum Europe, for joining us here on Let's Talk for Public Code.
Thank you very much, Jan.
This is the end of this episode. You can subscribe to ensure that you get future episodes at podcast.publiccode.net. Usually we record these live, and if you like to join the chat, then you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you can also watch previous episodes. We will be back with a new episode in about a month. If you want to engage in even more interactive sessions, you can join us in our community calls, which you can sign up for in the link in the footer in our website at publiccode.net. Bye for now.